Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Bob Hickok. Bob Hickok is Associate Professor of English at Virginia Tech University. He is the author of This Clumsy Living, Insomnia Diary, Animal Soul, a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award, Plus Shipping, and The Legend of Light. His new book, entitled Words for Empty and Words for Fool, was just published in 2010 by the University of Pittsburgh Press. Hickok is the recipient of a Guggenheim Fellowship, two NEA Fellowships, the Rebecca Johnson Bobbitt National Poetry Prize from the Library of Congress, the Felix Pollack Prize, the Jerome J. Shestack Prize, and four Pushcart Prizes. His poems have appeared in six volumes of Best American Poetry. Hi, Bob. How you doing?
All right. How are you, Jan?
Good. It's good to see you, and we're happy to have you on the show. This is the first time you've been on the show, I think, right?
I think it's the second.
Is it?
But I was trying to remember when it was.
Wow, that would have been a while ago then. Yeah. Well,
like,
welcome back.
1909.
Yeah, when we were young. Okay. Okay, you're going to read something from your new book.
Sure.
Okay.
This first poem is called After the Procedure. All the apples have been washed. I sprayed every apple with a liquid that cleans pesticides away. I prayed very leap myself with a quid that kneels pesty vices away. On the counter, pictures of my wife's stomach, her esophagus and duodenum, A-OK her inner life, while she sleeps drugs on the couch, while she rugged peels know the slouch. The worm crawled in, took pictures. Endoscopy. The sun comes in, warms my eyes, drops bits of far away against my looking. I am grateful. She fully great. She will rise and be herself, a dash inside out, invaded, but here and projected in that state to remain. I am thinking soup. I ma, thin king of dew. Do make lunch, wash dishes, do inspect her breath. It is there, the up and down. I kiss her paper esophagus. Intimacy evolves. Intimacy solves. I never expected love. All the apples have been washed. This next poem is called Wet Work. The river's out there in the dark. The blind river's out there in the dark. The feeling of water is out there in the dark. It's time to find out if I can walk my path with eyes closed in the dark. I picture myself doing this, but in my imagination, I can always see. Even when I tell myself to turn off the light in my mind, the words, the shapes themselves of me turning off the light are a kind of light. The words, the shapes, a moon. To walk is a river whose mind is touch, whose mantra is not unlike lowing. I'll close my eyes, I'll moan. Then I'll open my eyes and go to the river to be critiqued. The river is always full of suggestions about how to be a river and fish. And once the head of a doll went by, and only a year later, the body, the most buoyant estrangement I've ever decided is a parable. The parable of the child who killed her doll. The parable of wading in and holding the body and saying, she didn't mean it. Of letting the body go. The parable of waving at what passes because it is passing. Of waving harder at things standing still. This is Man to Man. 13 killed by a man in Germany and then himself. 10 killed by a man in Alabama, and then himself. I have killed no one. I am behind. Are they out there and we just don't hear them? Stories of men who go crazy and mow the lawns of strangers. What was he like? The interviewer would ask a neighbor. Kind of quiet, she would say. You know, kept to himself. A nice man, really. And then he was just like, you know, mowing, mowing and mowing and mowing and mowing. There were grass clippings everywhere. It was horrible. A man kills his girlfriend and then himself. A man dresses as Santa, kills his family and then himself. On that day, I stood under a tree. My standing under the tree moved a crow from that tree to a tree across the road. When that crow moved, a second crow and a third crow followed, and I thought, I have moved the crows, and thought, when I followed, the crows have moved me. I have done this a year now, gone from tree to tree by crow, shooting no one as I go. A man paints his wife green and then himself. A man scolds the tulips and apologizes to the roses. A man gathers all the men in the world and asks why rock, paper, scissors won't do. Why rock, paper, scissors, fire won't do. Why rock, paper, scissors, fire, atom bomb won't do. The sound of all men shrugging sounds like the sound of all crows taking off from all trees, like the day flying away from itself. A man kills the day and then himself. A man kills the sun and then himself. I am telling you, Alpha Centauri, man to star, run.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Bob Hickok. And he's reading from his new book, Words for Empty and Words for Full. And I really like that poem you just read.
Thank you.
Yeah. Brings up some questions about structure. I really like in your poems how, you know, I'm listening or reading and I feel like I'm in a seeming narrative and then all of a sudden there's this leaping or there's this imaginative work that happens and happens and happens and then it seems like I'm in a narrative again that seems more orderly, traditionally orderly, right? So I wanted to ask you about how you put those things together, how you came upon that kind of style, which seems yours to me.
Thank you. I like that. Boredom. Boredom, I think, is what really changed my work. Boredom with my work.
Oh, okay.
I began, I think, as a traditionally narrative poet. Mm-hmm. And there was something about just writing a certain number of poems that induced a natural kind of fatigue.
Yeah.
I don't think it's inherent to narrative. My guess is it would have come no matter what I was writing. It was more the fact that I, as my hands went to move toward the keyboard, I had such a fundamental sense of what I was about to do. And when that showed up and I responded to it, my work began to change.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's because of that, boredom is one of the things I've suggested to people that they really pay attention to. And that it's one of the better catalysts you're ever going to find.
Mm-hmm. So it wasn't a situation where you felt like, oh, I have in this new work, I want to do something different. I want my work to shift and change. You just got tired of what you were doing.
Yeah. I mean, I think for myself, like most of us, there is this desire to change, a conscious desire to change. And there's ways I have gone about that. In a lot of respects, I trust stuff that's the forces that are more subterranean that might change us, directions that arrive less consciously, I think oftentimes have a greater force. And the times when I have felt this fatigue have, I think, been the most fruitful.
Mm-hmm.
There was one point where actually the fatigue I felt was in response to this kind of poem, I think, that you're talking about. They felt just chattery to me and annoying.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew roughly what I was going to do. And it wasn't until I let the lines lengthen
mm-hmm.
that I felt calm, that I felt like writing again.
Mm-hmm.
And there have been pretty distinct points where that has occurred, some fundamental sort of disquiet with what I was doing. And for me, it's been more just trying different things, and then something shows up, and I like that, and that gets rid of the boredom or the annoyance that I feel with mm-hmm. the work, and then I go forward.
So it's a body response, too. You said yeah. It, you felt calm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Also, it seems like you take a lot of risks with repetition. I mean, in the man-to-man poem, you said, I knew a man who, and I think that's kind of risky. You'll repeat full lines, and listening to you read, I feel, oh, he's doing it again. And, but it's a pleasant surprise, but it's still a surprise. And yet it seems kind of crazy that repeating a line would be such a surprise because, well, mostly because people don't do it that much.
Yeah, this is kind of fascinating to me because I, for the longest time, I wouldn't repeat things.
Yeah.
And there came a point, I listened to someone read a pantoum.
Mm-hmm.
Why are you so concerned about repeating stuff? There's actually great value in doing that.
And there is.
I found myself opening up to that. And if anything, now I'm feeling I've kind of gone too far the other way. But it's not a social measurement. It's a personal measurement. A lot of times for me, the most important thing to do is notice tendencies, indulge them for a period of time, and then sort of move away from them, trusting that if they're really something you like and that you've learned to do, they'll stick around.
Sure.
You will always be able to call on that. But again, there's tremendous value in nudging yourself away from these things.
But I agree.
It's kind of cool to think back to when you saying, noting repetition, I would have cringed.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's like, oh, yeah, I'm glad you like that. That's all right. Because I wouldn't have done that before.
Yeah, it's good to move. It's good to move. Could you read some more poems?
No.
Oh, come on, Bob.
That's it. I'm done. I'm out of here. This is called Weebles Wobble, But They Don't Fall Down. I know a woman about to lose her house. It's not missing. She's certain where the water shutoff valve is and which stair squeaks when she goes up at 10 to rise at 4. I promised myself I wasn't going to do this. No one listens to this kind of poem anyway. It might as well be a sermon or the side of a cereal box. The Lord has heard my cry for mercy. Contents may have settled during shipping. Now she has to self-store her stuff but doesn't have the moolah to do so. And her brother's stuff from his repoed house is already in their mother's basement. So she's sold what she can and given the rest away or left it on the street for neighbors to pick at through January. Ever watch the woman who backed over your cat hold one of your dresses across her winter coat, pinning it with her chin and turning as if in a mirror before rejecting your sunflowers, dropping them into the curbside thaw and moving on to a pair of black pumps she'd be a fool to wear given the apples of her ankles. Now caption that image, redistribution of wealth, and write down on a piece of paper how you'd change the world. You never have to show that paper to anyone, not even yourself. The god you are inside or pimp the axe in case of the glass to break if fire is emergency is now. It's hard being a wobbly these days, liking the head of Marx if not the fist grafted on. There's nowhere to go to belt out, look for the union label, an admittedly crappy, anachronistic song I miss, like I miss the sense of being together in this. There was Rockefeller and there was the rest of us. There was Aristotle being right. We are political. We are animal. We are lost. Kinesis. The cutting board falls sideways because of the cookie sheet behind it and breaks the Krupp's carafe. I go online thinking Krupp's made munitions for Germany using Jews to death to find they sell the carafe for not much and order it, hoping slave labor's not involved. I make coffee with the press pot and notice that we're out of painkillers for Sasha's hips when they don't actually kill the pain, do they? Just like I don't really love you to death, I do actually love you for putting the green bottle of no more painkillers out where I'd see it while I was thinking, thanks to Krupp's, of Tefillin, sacred words on parchment in kosher leather boxes, strapped to the forehead is excellent devotional weirdness in my book, And how many cups of coffee does this press pot make? Sasha limps more and more these days, as do I. Your ears are ringing off the hook. God is calling to say he's not coming. A local kid was killed yesterday in the war, shot clean through the head. What's clean about this? Dirty through, nasty through, toothsome and biting through. I've been working on the lexicon all the livelong day. While my coffee's too hot to drink, the wind picks up to tell me I better ask if you'd prefer not buying anything by Krupps. Like you don't want a Volkswagen, even though the new bug's cute, because of the 6 million instances of ash you're a part of. Like every drop of water's a citizen of its cloud. We can do that. Cancel the order. Stop drinking coffee. Use the Greek word phylactery instead of tefillin, which I enjoy saying, phylactery. It sounds like factory and prophylactic put together. Doesn't it seem like every second, if you stop, has this whole life inside it that is so completely yours, it would die without you dying to never be without it? I want to live to be 362. We should have a new coffee pot by then that doesn't make us feel like we're waking to genocide. Though we are, and good morning. Democracy in traction. They'll try the 10-year-old as an adult for plugging his pops. At 10, I was 1 year older than 9, one less inclined to suck my thumb in the open, but at night, I slurped the nailed and milkless nipple. I don't think my pajamas had footies anymore, those training wheels of sleep. But I had a blankie for sure, and no clue purposeful erections and pubes were coming, no sense of stridex or zits. It was a marvel of a year because it occupied every finger and thumb. I was double digit, a Roman X, a big boy in the bullcrap parlance of Grupps. So what would a jury of my peers have looked like? Crew cuts and kids, Super Bowl bouncing, Twinkie scarfing, Gilligan's Island loving nap takers, everyone. Charged with indifference to cooties, I'd have done major time for touching Mary Dilworth's knee. What a knee it was, scraped hinge below the pink plumage I didn't know was there. 10, the year I was nearly 11 the whole year. Somewhere a DA sleeps who shouldn't. Somewhere Canadians would never do this. Oh, Canada. At this rate, for safety's sake, we'll soon arrest not just the fetus, but the womb.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Bob Hickok, and he's reading from his new book, Words for Empty and Words for Full. I love the range of language that you have in your work, especially a lot of cultural references, but it just makes me happy to hear the words. Like, I've written some of them down, like moolah, repoed, pimp, kinesis. I mean, pimp is next to kinesis. I mean, in your work, not exactly, but planky, footies, pubes, et cetera, et cetera. And it's just, there's a sort of instant recognition or instant joy that comes just from hearing that language, I think. It's just wobbly, you know, you don't hear it that much anymore. And it's especially interesting near, you know, some other kind of studied language that shows up in your work too. Is that are you intentionally mixing, or is that just what comes from your body when you write, you know?
It's not intentional. I think I've been fortunate in that I've never had a sense of right and wrong speech, which can be a problem. Said to someone last night, in looking over poems to read, I did a reading last night, I was surprised how often I swear in the poems.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a good way to go at this question, because even the words that we tend to think of as having a very specific context, or words that we think of as being weighted in one direction or another, they've never struck me that way. It's all language. It's all a poor attempt, really, to get at something that we're never actually going to get at fully. So I want everything available, anything that comes to mind that feels like it fits the moment, it fits the sense of what I'm driving at. Mm-hmm. I want to be able to use it.
Yeah, and it should be available to you, and it is. And yeah, I agree with that. There are many out there who would say that, you know, straddling registers of language in a poem is not a good idea. But I disagree with that, unless you have some grand plan of lexicon, you know, at work, blah, 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 you know.
This came up recently. Someone asked me about using contemporary things. And she said, "Why are you worried that's going to date your poems?" And I said, I have no sense what's going to go on with these anyway. I mean, the overwhelming odds are that my work will disappear. Most of what we do will simply disappear. What I wish I would have said was that if I don't use my language, I am not going to get across my meaning. Mm-hmm. So to try to come at it in a straitjacketed way with a sense of what are the proper words to use would literally be to take a portion of my mind and say, well, I can't use this. I can't go there.
Yeah, exactly.
And it doesn't work.
Yeah, it's a form of self-censorship
then.
I wanted to mention at least the there's a great, seeming like a great sense of the political in your work. And do you think that that has some relationship to your work as, would you call yourself a machinist? You used to be a machinist, or I know you were a die, automotive die designer.
Yeah. The work I did was not, a machinist is actually making the objects.
Okay.
I designed things. These large objects that stamp out car parts that a machinist would have built.
Mm-hmm. Do you see a relationship between your work and, you know, you're writing about union, you know?
Yeah, I do. That's certainly a strain of what I've done, probably always done. I don't know why, because I've had a kind of blessed existence, even though I did work in factories when I was younger. It was always understood that I was going to go on to college.
Mm-hmm.
There was never really a sense for me or within my family that that was going to be my life.
Mm-hmm.
But it's an affinity I've always felt for mm-hmm. some reason. Laborers, farmers.
Yeah. Okay, we have time for a few more poems.
Okay. This poem is called BRCA1. And it came about because a friend of mine is married to a woman who is one of those folks who her family has a history of breast cancer. And she had the test for the genes which identify it. And she was likely to develop breast cancer, and she had things removed. She has the gene, the cytosine, adenine her mother's sister had. Her southern mister had. They've named the gene. If I named a gene, I'd name it Gene. I knew a gene, brother to Greg. We are like, genetically, mice, tiny creatures with toes. She is like, genetically, 87% likely to have breast cancer, ovarian cancer, ovum, oppen, open, closed. So come July, away with thee, mammaries and ovaries live together in imperfect harmony. It only takes a day to remove the real and add, pick a word, prosthetic, cosmetic, the faux breasts and the egg sacs are just gone, call them the nothings, the novaries. And there I am, was cringing, and there she is, was smiling, touching my hand, saying, no, 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 this is a good thing, the best thing the universe has come up with since the wet kiss. I am taking dialogic license there. But she was happy as a torch in a Frankenstein flip. The townspeople have gathered to kill the monster. It's dark, but they have fire. She has fire. She's going to kill the monster that killed her mother, her sister. If I may pare a phrase down to its essentials, hooray, but ouch, hooray, but seriously, ouch. And the world one day had a second sky, a sky for just the sky to stare up in deep blue and into, and a lake for the lake to dive giggling in and doggy paddle across, and a new and soon improved her sitting there midlife, grinning brights, grinning hardcore and full bore and seriously madcap happy about a knife. This is in the future will be the past. A woman screamed during the protest between supporters of Arabs on one side and Israelis on the other that Jews should go back to the ovens. There's a picture of her on the web in a white scarf, mouth open, everything slightly blurry because she was moving, or the camera was, or the earth jumped a bit at what she said. As I looked at the picture, Eve was behind me folding a shirt, sleeves first and then in half again the other way, making me glad I'm not a shirt. She coughed and I saw her in an oven. This wasn't a thought, but a vision. Not a Jew in an oven, but this Jew in an oven. Not this Jew in an oven, but these lips, eyes, this voice made ash. I got up and kissed her to make sure she was there, not telling her she'd just died in my brain. Then sat before the screen and stared again at the picture of the woman, refreshing my gaze at whatever rate humans do who want to know what it feels like to wear a particular head, to own a different tongue. Sure that, if I could meet her, if the crowd dispersed, if screaming were put aside, if she sat across a table from Eve and saw her stirring coffee, worrying a hair into place, and I gave this woman paper and pencil and told her, I am a god. You can sketch anything you want to happen, and it will happen. She wouldn't sketch an oven and Eve in the oven. Wouldn't draw fire but a hill, as all children draw hills, as all adults are children in the universe in which I am a god. A hill with a view of other wavings from other hills. These are examples of the thoughts I have of people, as these are examples of questions I ask the falling snow. If I could burn a sock, could I burn a foot? If a foot, a finger, if a finger, an ear. If an ear, a womb, could I ever burn a womb, snow? In your opinion, how did we get here?
It's the poetry of Bob Hickok. Thank you so much for being here.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
It was great. You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in every Tuesday night at 7 for Prosody, 91.3 WYEP.